All right, so first things first. Probably the people that I offended last week didn't come back. But that article that I read to you last week on class difference.
Oh, really? Okay.
So the article I read to you last week on class differences, I should have introduced it by saying that this is about generality. It's about research on large samples of people, so the conclusions that they came to, the findings that they made, have to do with the average of people, or the general statement about people in different classes. It has nothing in those articles talked about any individual. Individuals vary hugely in how they behave. And in fact, in Santa Barbara, many people have done very well and are quite fortunate and are super concerned about the fortunes of others and do heroic things to help other people. So it doesn't mean that everybody in higher classes is insensitive and narcissistic and greedy and all these kind of things. What that article did do is it underlined two things. First, the over the whole population, certain trends. And second, it underlined the perceptions that people have about how people in the different social classes behave. And it also talked about the effect of social class on people's outlook. But again, if you're one of these people who has done well in life financially and is working really hard to help everybody else do similarly well, then that article didn't apply to you. Okay? Does that make sense to people?
Yeah.
Because I don't want people to think, oh God, I have to...
No, I'm a terrible person for having been a good person. It's not. All right, so that was
last week. Let's dispense with that. What's on my mind, even before we sit and meditate? Half an hour ago, I was thinking about a class that I gave last night, a positive psychology class. And something that we talked about in that class, I thought, I want to tell these folks about it just very briefly, because we have a huge amount of stuff to do today. But while it's on my mind, last night we talked about the negativity bias that is built into each of us evolutionarily. That is, the earlier structures in our brain, the middle and lower part of our brain, basically ignore everything that is the same and everything that is non-threatening, and we pay special attention on a very deep level, neuropsychologically, to things which change, and we scan them for potential threat. So the middle of our brains is ignoring everything that's going right, and it's constant, and it's constantly looking for what's changing, is it a threat, what's changing, is it a threat. And what that negativity bias that's built into us evolutionarily so we can survive, what it does is, unless you redress it with the top of your brain, unless you use the more evolutionarily recent parts of your brain, like the prefrontal cortex, to rebalance yourself, you're going to walk around thinking the world is a bunch of potential threats and scanning for them. So we have to use our better judgment, our more recent way of thinking, to say, hey, I don't want to go around ignoring what is okay in the world. But I don't want to distort. You don't want a distorted picture of the world, and your brain will give you a distorted picture of the world unless you consciously undistort that picture by rebalancing what you're paying attention to. Does that make sense to people? That, we ignore We ignore the fact that it's a beautiful day and we're sitting in a nice place with nice people, and we think about, oh God, that headline about that thing that's going to happen, or the snowstorm back east or whatever, and we focus on the potential threats and we ignore the reality of the situation. The extreme of this is what they call a me world syndrome in psychology. That is, people that watch the news too much or media too much, they think the world is a terrible place because what is the news telling us? Why is the news telling us the bad news? Because we pay attention to the bad news, right? Okay, so Carl.
I like to think of this as if we're slightly neurotic, it helps us to survive, but it doesn't help us to get ahead because we're totally blind to opportunities.
Yeah.
Yeah, but if you pay, it's well said, if you pay attention to threat all the time, you're blind to, as Carl said, what the possibilities are. So yeah. All right. Okay, so let's see, Betsy.
Well, if you have that new world syndrome, what's the best way to
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics says no child under 10 should watch the news at all, and above 10 you should watch the news with your parents. In other words, don't look at the world through that lens. And again, the reason that lens is up there is because of negativity bias. That is, you want to tell people what could potentially be threatening to them. That's the altruistic reason that the news shows the bad news. And the not-so-altruistic reason is, what do you pay attention to? What can't you turn off? What might threaten you? What might hurt you? So we're all, oh, good, God, 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 okay, so Annie.
To me, I don't deny anything that's happening, but I have free will to turn my attention wherever I want to, and energy flows where attention goes. So I'm dedicated to energizing what I desire to see and feel.
And also, there's two levels. One level of it is you choose your reality.
That's right.
And the second level of it is, if you want to be in touch with actual reality, don't let the negativity bias determine your outlook, because it will only show you a piece of reality, the piece that could gobble you up. Okay, let's see, a couple of hands, and then we'll, so, Gary.
Any recent articles about this that brought this to your mind or anything?
It's part and parcel of why there is positive psychology. When they're arguing, why do we have to have a positive psychology? Why are we so focused on the negative in psychological practice, in psychological research, for the last 100 years since it's been psychology? Why is there all this stuff about what's wrong and nothing until recently about what's right? Because of the negativity bias, because our natural tendency is to look for what could eat us. Petale.
Does the same thing go for Pacifica? Like, my parents got me started on KPFA and KPFK 60 years ago, and it's hard to break the habit, and I think it might make you anxious. Have you listened? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. I mean, the question is, KPFA and KPFK, public radio, okay?
Progressive
radio. They might, if you pay attention to that, it might make you very angry because they show you all the injustices and difficulties in the world, right? In Buddhism, they say you have to make your mind a qualified environment and take into your mind that which is useful for you, rather than indiscriminately taking into your mind whatever is going around in the air. All right, there was one more hand in there. Okay, so Lisa.
Well, this is just kind of messed up and bring it up and sort of relate. I heard a talk yesterday when I went to lunch of a fellow that was British, but he just came back from Egypt and lived there for a number of years, 16, 20 years. And it was of a different faith. And he told how warm the Muslims were to him, how kind, how everybody lived together, and there's no problem because we're just getting the whole thing about the Muslims.
Yeah.
And I just...
It's distorted.
It's very interesting. You're saying he's been there firsthand and lived there.
I mean, that's been said a lot recently, which is If you look at the very, if you pick the very worst of something and you focus on that, you ignore what the reality is. You know, it could be for any ethnic or religious group. You could look at the worst of it and you could generalize the whole group. For people that came in late, I wanted to tell you that at the very beginning of class, what I said is last week's class did not apply to individuals. And many people who are very well off are very, very concerned for the social welfare of other people and are heroic and are not, shouldn't be demonized. Okay? So that's what I said again. Okay, Robert.
Yeah, this is about watching the news. Things that people are saying worry me. You know, Helen Caldicott, I remember she was here last night, but she spoke many times, and she said that children actually benefit psychologically when they see their parents acting to make the world a better place. So you have to watch the news in order to know what it is that's needed to make the world a better place.
If you're going to watch the news with your kids, you look at what's, you know, on the news, and then you say, here's what we can do about it. So otherwise, if your kids just watch the news, they get scared. But if you say, look, here are the action steps that we can take to make that better, then you're teaching your kids, A, there's hope, and B, there's responsibility.
There's things you can do.
Yeah, and you're teaching your kids to be responsible and not to be passive and defeated. Okay, that's all of which was preamble. Okay, now let's talk a little bit about mindfulness. I don't have a lot to coach you with today, but the two things I wanted to underline for you are, first, if you want a clearer picture of what you're experiencing, then label what you're experiencing. Most of you I've taught this to, but just extremely brief review, you're feeling yourself breathe. Remember I told you last week, breathe with your whole body. Belly goes out, your chest goes up, your body turns out. Then when you breathe out, your belly goes in, your chest comes down, so it's like this. I'm exaggerating hugely, but you will, if you pay attention to your breathing, notice that there's an opening up and a closing down. Opening up and closing down. So you keep paying attention to that, and you'll begin to notice other things. Thoughts in your head, which take you away from your breathing, then you come back. Feelings, sensations, from within your body and around you, you're noticing those things. So if those things aren't very clear, if it's just kind of fuzzy in there, then what you can do is you can label. You can say, you can call out to yourself silently the thing you're most predominantly aware of. So an example. Now, my awareness goes like that, okay? So I can't call all that out. I'm just going to call out the most predominant thing. Mouth, shoulders, mouth, eyes, neck, heart, fingers, hearing, thinking, heart, hands, seat, hearing, feeling, thinking, feeling. So I'm just calling out the thing that was most predominant in my attention. And what that does, for a minute or two of that, it focuses the lens. So you're clear about what you're experiencing, which leads me to my second comment. The witnessing perspective, that which we are cultivating, we're trying to develop. The witnessing perspective involves not trying to get away from anything, not trying to cause anything to happen, not trying to change anything. It involves simply opening to your experience without reservation. So if you're sad, you don't try to change your sadness or analyze your sadness. You just feel sad. If you're angry, you just feel angry. If you're happy, you just feel happy. If you're thinking, you let yourself think. If you're hearing, you let yourself hear. If there's a pain, you pay attention to the pain. So why is this any different than just walking around the way we're normally walking around? Because you keep coming back to your breathing, you don't get absorbed in the things you notice. So you open to your experience, but you have the experience. You're the experiencer, not the experience as. Instead of being these things and not knowing what's going on and kind of getting soaked in the storm of yourself occasionally, or frequently, or constantly, you take a step back when you pay attention to your breathing and you open to the full catastrophe, as Jon Kabat-Zinn calls it, right? You just open to the whole deal, and whatever's going through your head, your heart, your body, and around you, you notice it. You become more aware of what the inner world and the outer world, and less caught up in it. And how do you do that? You just keep coming back to your breathing, and opening your awareness around your breathing, so that whatever is there, you notice. So that's what witnessing is. That's mindfulness. The problem is you get absorbed in things. Something preoccupies you. Oh God, that's horrible. Oh, that's just so wonderful. You know, you get pulled out of your seat. And another way to say this is keep your seat. It's a theater. Don't go up on stage and tell the actors how to behave. Just keep sitting in your seat going, wow. Okay. All right, so that's what we're trying to do. All right, so let's do it. We'll sit for 10 minutes. Basic instruction. Don't try to figure this out. Just come back to your breathing with your awareness and soften and open. Just let yourself relax, come back to your breathing. That's your whole being. What I said last week is you might want to feel yourself joining with the earth. And you might want to feel your breathing with your whole body. And you will notice various things. Just notice them. Don't operate on them. Just notice them. So when people are starting to learn mindfulness, I tell them not to practice for very long. To practice every day if possible, but for a few minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes at the most. But 5 minutes is a good start. Otherwise, it becomes a chore and you stop doing it. But when you've been practicing for a little while, then I suggest that every once in a while you sit for a little longer. The reason is because you may have noticed that your awareness is like a wild horse. It goes charging all over the place, and typically when you're wound up, it charges very quickly from thing to thing. As you sit, it slows down. And when it slows down enough, you feel more calm and clear, and the things that you're aware of become clearer to you. There are less of them, so they stand out more completely. And there are times when there's really nothing going on except just this open awareness, and then there comes a thought, and you can so clearly hear it or see it. So with a little bit longer practice session, the elements of your experience become more prominent. And you can look at them more clearly with less merging with them, with more independence from them. Okay? All right, on the subject of mindfulness, no, not on the subject of mindfulness, a couple of announcements, and then on the subject of mindfulness for a little while. First, for next week's class, bring writing materials. You'll need paper, pencil or pen, and something to write on. A clipboard, a book, something that you can sit in your chair and write on. Okay? Because we're going to be doing an active experience. Secondly, next week is the last week of this term. Then I think we have a 3-week break, I'm guessing. And then we start again for 6 weeks, April and May. I'm ending in mid-May because I'm trying to get out of here for a couple of weeks. I don't know if it'll happen, but if I don't schedule anything for those last 2 weeks in May, I can go take a vacation before the kids get out of school, and I can have a reasonable amount of quietude in the backcountry, wherever I decide to go. So it'll be April to mid-May. In that 6-week session, I have 2 guests, and 4 of the classes I'll teach. But the 2 guests that I have are Dave Humes is going to come and talk to us about a shaman's view of death, a rather remarkable presentation. Okay, so he's going to come, and then Dave Rico is going to come, and I asked him to talk to us about poetry. Because although Dave Rico is a psychologist and has written all these books about psychology, and I shouldn't say this, so don't tell him I said this, but I think you will notice, when he talks about psychology, he's very calm and very precise, and you know, his voice is very nice, and you know, he's very clear and says wonderful things. But when he talks about poetry, there's a passion that comes into him. Because his real passion is poetry. And so I asked him to talk about poetry, because I think that it will be revelatory, both artistically and psychologically. You'll see. He's amazing about poetry. So those are the 2 guests we're going to have, and then the other 4 classes I will teach. And I will, at some point, say something about enlightenment. I promised you that a long time ago. We'll do a little bit of work on enlightenment this next term. Whatever that is. Okay. Okay. All right. Because mindfulness is really hitting the public eye, and so I thought that I would just read a couple of things or mention a couple of things about mindfulness to you. First is part of an article from the New York Times on the 24th of February. By the way, whoever gave this to me, thank you. Whoever did this? Who did this? Who gave you this little New York Times article? Anybody sitting here? Marianne, yeah. Thank you. Okay. All right, so. Now, this is the opposite. Mindfulness is supposed to be about being more aware, right? But this article, which is very short, is meditate on a good night's sleep. You have chronic sleep problems. You may be able to significantly improve your ability to get a restful night of sleep by practicing a popular form of meditation, a rigorous new study shows. The findings may be particularly relevant to Americans older than age 55, about half of whom have some form of sleep trouble. So if you're having difficulty, well, first of all, when you get older, you don't sleep the whole night. You get up a bunch of times. That's not sleep trouble. But a lot of people have trouble getting to sleep or staying asleep. More than half the population over 55. So the research, a clinical trial published in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine, recruited about 50 older adults with moderate sleep problems and assigned them to follow one of two programs. In one group, the adults learned behaviors that could help them develop good sleep hygiene, like establishing a regular bedtime routine and avoiding caffeine and alcohol before bed. So normal sleep counseling for that group. The other group underwent a six-week program on mindfulness meditation, the non-judgmental awareness of the thoughts and feelings drifting through one's mind, led by a certified teacher. So normal sleep hygiene counseling versus six-week mindfulness course. At the end of the year-long study, the people who learned the mindfulness approach had greater improvements in sleep quality and fewer symptoms of insomnia, depression, and fatigue than those who received the standard care. Then it just says it doesn't have any side effects. Which is not.
Makes you less neurotic.
What? Except it makes you less neurotic, and so you're right, you're less apt to fuel the big pharma machine. Okay, so that was the first thing. Second thing, I promised you last, I said to you, I just received the night before last class the Monitor on Psychology, and the front cover article was on mindfulness and depression. So I told you I would summarize that article for you now. I'm actually not going to, because the article itself is kind of lame. It's about mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is just you notice your thoughts really clearly, and you correct the ones that are not useful or realistic. When you're mindful, you're more. It's clearer what you're thinking, so you're more able to notice those thoughts and change them efficiently. Cognitive therapy is just change your thoughts. You know, notice and change your thoughts. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy is, from that perspective, you're more clear about your thoughts, so they're more easily noticed and they're more easily changed. In any event, what it says in that article at some length is, for relapsing depression, and most depression is relapsing, at least 80% of depressive episodes recur. For relapsing depression, mindfulness seems to be the most effective technique we know to prevent relapse. That's what it said. But an addendum to that article, I'm going to read all to you, one page, okay? The addendum is called Mindfulness and Mood Disorders in the Brain, and it's about new research on what mindfulness does to combat mood disorders. Mindfulness training holds promise for treating mood disorders, partly because it may lead to changes in patients' brains, improving connectivity among some brain areas, and changing tissue density in key regions, research suggests. The evidence indicates that when people pay attention to the present moment, an experiential self-reference, when you pay attention to the present moment, we're calling that experiential self-reference. I am paying attention to the present moment. They use a different set of neural pathways than when they engage in narrative self-reference to think about experiences over time. Narrative self-reference is, I was there this morning and I have these problems and I'm going to have these problems later on. So narrative self-reference is about me with regard to my life story. as opposed to what's happening right now. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, MBCT, encourages people with mood disorders to pay attention to sensations and feelings rather than to evaluative thoughts. Pay attention to what you're actually sensing and feeling now rather than to what's going through your mind. This, in turn, exercises and strengthens the pathways involved in experiential self-reference, what's happening now. Quote, mindfulness changes the brain by allowing people to access this present moment pathway, says Zindel Siegel, a professor at the University of Toronto. This is vitally important for working with sad mood states. If patients haven't had mindfulness training, Siegel adds, they'll continually activate their pathways for narrative self-references. Oh, I'm so sad. Oh, I'm so sad. My life is so bad. They will continually activate their pathways for narrative self-reference and executive control. I have to do something about this. And their present moment pathways will get weaker. They'll be more obsessed with their story and less focused on their actual moment-to-moment experience without mindfulness training. Researchers are exploring how the ability to live in the moment may persist beyond mindfulness practice sessions. One study by Veronique Taylor and colleagues at the University of Montreal that used fMRI to compare experienced meditators with novice meditators found that even in the resting state, when you're not meditating, the former, the experienced meditators, had less activities among areas of the brain involved in self-referential thoughts. That is to say, experienced meditators don't spend a lot of time thinking about their life, life story. They spend more time paying attention to what's actually happening at the present moment. They're less caught up in their thoughts and more present to life. Mindfulness may even change tissue density in some regions. Harvard University neuroscientist Sarah Lazar and colleagues. Mindfulness may even change tissue density in some regions of the brain. Harvard University neuroscientist Sarah Lazar and colleagues took MRIs of 16 participants who'd never meditated and then scanned them again after they participated in an 8-week mindfulness-based stress reduction program. So 8 weeks is not a long time to be meditating, but they find changes in the brain. The researchers found that participants' gray matter density shrank in the amygdala. The amygdala is the part in the middle of your brain that has to do with fight or flight. So the amygdala gets smaller. Your alarm bell gets less loud when you have practiced mindfulness, even for a short time. And the change was correlated with decreases in stress. That is, people who are mindful experience less stress and cause less stress reaction in their body. There was no control group for the study. Okay. The amygdala is also implicated in anxiety disorders. Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. That's the amygdala going off all the time. Which may be one way in which mindfulness helps ease anxiety and stress as well as depression. An additional analysis of the same group of participants showed that they also had increases in density in two other brain regions. The posterior cingulate cortex, which is at the top of your brain, but not the very top. So the posterior cingulate cortex, which is related to sustained attention. People who practice mindfulness were able to grow the part of their brain which is able to sustain attention. That is to keep attention on one thing by design. You know, attention goes all over the place. When you learn mindfulness, you learn to rest your attention or point your attention where you want it to go and keep it there, which is a huge skill. And also more tissue density in the left hippocampus, the horseshoe-shaped structure in the middle of your brain, which may contribute to emotional regulation. That is, an area of your brain which helps you to regulate feelings actually gets thicker in just 8 weeks. In addition, researchers saw changes in areas of the brain Researchers saw changes in areas of the brainstem potentially related to serotonin production, alterations that were positively correlated with self-reported aspects of psychological well-being. Those of you who know, those of you who take SSRIs, that's to keep serotonin in your synapses longer so it can calm you down. Serotonin is a calming, reassuring neurotransmitter. Well, these people made more serotonin in their brainstem. The neural changes brought about by mindfulness appear to be following the basic rules of neuroplasticity, Lazar says. If you practice something new, then you're going to get enhanced connectivity in neural structures, she explains. That can mean an increase in the number of synapses, the wiring between the nerve cells, or changes in neurotransmitter release that promote an increase in function. Still, Lazar cautions that mindfulness isn't a quick fix. Resulting neurological changes are likely to be temporary and thus require continued practice. The good news is you can change your brain really quickly. The bad news is it changes back unless you continue to practice what you're practicing. So this is just a little bit there's so much neuropsychological, there's so much neuroscience evidence coming in right now about the effect of mindfulness. In one sense, I don't care. I know that, you know. But in another sense, it's reassuring to know that you're changing your brain structure and function even as you sit for a few minutes a day. Okay? So it gives you a pat on the back and a boot on the butt to keep going. Okay?
In that study, Spencer, how long did they sit for that study?
It didn't say, but you know, typically for a mindfulness-based stress reduction program, they typically sit for 3/4 of an hour a day. So these might have been people that were sitting for 45 minutes a day for 8 weeks. Because that's what happens typically in MBSR. Gary?
Is that part of the article that you gave us last week?
No. I didn't give this article out. So if anybody wants a copy of what I just read and the article which preceded it about mindfulness for relapse, I have copies here, and I also have copies of the article on cultural differences. I don't have a huge number of them, but if you come up after class, if you want a copy of each of those articles, or either of those articles, I did make copies. Now, did I give out something last week? No, I didn't.
No, but I put the one from last week on.
Oh, okay. So on the swt.org/Spencer website, there is the cultural differences article.
The one from last week.
Yeah, from last week.
Yeah, it's in the PDF articles.
Right, we went through that last week. So it's on the it's on the site, and I also have copies here. Okay. How many of you have read the articles in this week's Time magazine? Okay, so not too many of you. So those of you who have, this is either going to be boring as anything, or it's going to be a review of that which you have read, but probably didn't entirely absorb. Okay. So I want to read to you. Forgive me, there's no other way to do this. I have to read this to you, okay? So I'll try to read as best I can. I'll put the microphone on and I'll try to lower my voice so it's more pleasant. This is a double issue of Time magazine. It's the current issue. And on the front cover, there's a picture of this kid. And it says,
what's the date?
The date for this issue is February 23rd and March 2nd. 2015, and the front cover says, this baby could live to be 142 years old, and for reasons which Carl has detailed to us to some extent. Okay. But I'm going to read, so I'm not going to read the stuff that you talked about, Carl. I'm going to read some other stuff. There are many, probably 8 or 9 articles on longevity and healthy functioning later in life. I'm going to read parts of some of those articles to you because I think they're really important. and they're really well done. They put a lot of information together quickly
or succinctly. By the way, these articles on healthy living and longevity and what promotes healthy aging and living longer are right after an article on the newest hamburgers, all of which are 1,000 calories and totally loaded with fat. You wouldn't believe it. I just thought, my God, you know, that's like paving. It's called Beefed Up. And it's all about the newest ones you can get at all the fast food places and how much thicker they are and fattier they are.
Okay.
All right. All right, so. So, can you hear me now? Is it?
I need to be up higher.
I don't know if I can get up. Where would higher be? Okay, can you hear me now?
No. All right. How about this? This likewise. How about this? Yeah. All right. Is this, if I talk at this level, can you hear me well?
Yes.
Higher? Higher?
Yes, we can.
Okay. How about this? Is this a good level? Yeah. Okay. Let's do that. All right, so can you still hear me well?
Yes.
Good. Okay. So this first article that I want to read much of to you is by Laura Carstensen, who is the director of the Stanford Center on Longevity. She's been writing about longevity for many years. She's a very prominent voice in the dialogue about longevity. And so this article is called The New Age of Much Older Age. We live in extraordinary times, and thanks to medical and scientific advances that even a generation ago would have sounded like science fiction, our lives are getting longer. An American born today has a projected average lifespan 20 full years longer than one born in 1925. And we are, as a society, growing old. For the first time in U.S. history, the number of people over 60 exceeds those under age 15. For the first time in U.S. history, the number of people over 60 exceeds those under age 15.
Is that the baby boomer bubble?
Say it?
Is that the baby boomer bubble?
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, partly the baby boomer. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah. Almost all the baby boomers are reached 60. Yeah,
but it's also the living
out. But it's also the lower birth rate. Okay. All right. So the challenge we face today is converting a world built quite literally by and for the young into a world that supports and engages populations that live to 100 years and beyond. This is no small feat. Consider, for example, that parks, transportation systems, staircases, and even hospitals presume that users have both strength and stamina. Suburbs across the country are built for two parents and their young children, not single people. Suburbs across the country are built for two parents and their young children, not single people, multiple generations, or elderly people who may be unable to drive. Our education system serves the needs of children and young adults and offers little more than recreation for experienced people. And we're fighting hard to keep to keep that not the case in Santa Barbara. Indeed, the very conception of work as a full-time endeavor ending in the early 60s is ill-suited to long lives. Arguably most troubling is that we fret about ways that older people lack the qualities of younger people, rather than exploit a growing new resource right before our eyes. Citizens who have deep expertise, emotional balance, and the motivation to make a difference. We're throwing away some of the best that we have to offer. You know, they put us out to pasture just when our contribution would be the most effective and appreciated. Longer lives and the fact that we're having fewer kids in combination began a global process by which population pyramids, with many at the bottom and a tiny portion of the old people at the top, are being transformed into rectangles. If you're the type of person who can get chills from population statistics, these are the numbers for you. What they mean is that for the first time in history, the majority of babies born in the developed world will have the opportunity to grow old. As much as we fancy ourselves free thinking, the crux of the longevity challenge is quite frequently that humans are creatures of culture. The culture that guides us today, that tells us when to get an education, marry, have children, buy a house, work, and retire, is profoundly mismatched to the length of the lives we're living. Today's culture offers little in the way of cures or even treatments for the chronic diseases that afflict older people. Nor does it offer guidance about how to finance decades-long retirements. And so individuals worry that they'll succumb to dementia, run out of money, lose their relevance. But it needn't be so. Instead of hand-wringing about productivity falling and infirmity rising, we need to change the course, both biologically and socially, of long life. With sufficient financial support, the potential of scientific advances is breathtaking. Biologists are beginning to understand that at a molecular level, the processes by which aging increases the risk of a whole range of diseases, and importantly, how to slow and even reverse some of these processes. The very nature of chronic degenerative diseases is being revealed, which paves the way for therapies and possibly even cures that were scarcely imagined a generation ago. 30 or more years of life also means we can improve the way we live. To the extent that we can build a world where people arrive at old age mentally sharp, physically fit, and financially secure, the problems of individual aging will recede. And finally, we can change the ongoing conversation about a crisis on the horizon to one about long life and new opportunities. So that's her preamble statement to the rest of these articles. I thought it's very well stated. And again, that's Laura Carstensen, the Stanford Center on Longevity. Then there's an article which Carl has talked to us about called Age Disruptors, about things like telomeres, and I'm not going to read that. Siamese linked mice, one of which is young and one of which is old, and the young blood makes the old blood better, or the old one better. I do want to buy GD... When we can buy GD11, you let me know, okay? When I can buy stock in the company making GD11, that's what I want to know.
That's
Harvard. Harvard has a strong patent position.
That's true.
Okay. And Stanford.
Okay. Places that don't need to get rich. All right. Then there's an article on where is the best place to be an old person. And it turns out to be Madison, Wisconsin, so we can skip that article. That one's about you want to live in a place, if you're older, you want to live in a place where there's good public transportation, older people around, you want to live in a city rather than way out there. You want to live in a place where there is where there's a lot of access to education, and where there are schools, and where there's a lot of activities. And Madison has a lot of that stuff. Peg.
Since when you said that, my toes started wriggling, and my answer instantly was right in these shoes. Where do you want to grow older? Right in these shoes.
Okay. But where do you want those shoes to grow older is the question. All right, so then there's a very depressing little chart here about when all the various organs of your body start to go down, and we long since passed that point. So I'm not going to read that article. All right. This article I'm going to read parts of because it's really the one that's most relevant for this class. It's by Jeffrey Kluger, who writes frequently for the for Time magazine about psychological things. I don't know what his background is, but he's the frequent writer about things psychological. So it's called Get Your Head in the Game. Okay. And again, I'm just excerpting this for the stuff that's the most relevant for us. It's no secret anymore that the familiar mind-body divide, with your head home to the abstract and ethereal, and your flesh home to the messy and mechanical, is nonsense. Your moods, feelings, and thoughts all influence your physiology. Learn to relax, and your blood pressure goes down. Emerge from depression, and your immune system picks up. Take a pharmacologically useless sugar pill that you're told is a powerful drug for your headache or backache or infection, and as if by magic, you get better. Placebo. The tantalizing question, then, has always been this. If the mind can heal the body, can it also rejuvenate it? Can it make it physically, measurably younger, or at the very least, slow the aging process? The people who research such things already accept that the way we think and feel can increase the population of the disease-fighting white blood cells and lower the level of the hormone that raises blood pressure. So why couldn't it recalcify, why couldn't the way we think and feel recalcify bones or reverse heart disease or preserve brain cells that are lost with age? You're only as old as you feel, you're only as old as you feel may merely be part of the equation. Perhaps within reason, you're only as old as you bloody well choose to be. Because research is mounting that your outlook, your personality, and frankly, how upbeat you are, have a profound impact not just on how you feel, but also on how your cells age. Quote, let's treat mind and body as just words, end quote, says Ellen Langer, a professor of psychology at Harvard University who has been studying aging, mindfulness, decision-making, and health since the late 1970s. Quote, let's put them together as one thing, mind and body, and say anywhere you put your mind, you also put your body, end quote. Once you make that leap, the medical toolkit becomes a lot larger. It includes not just pharmacology and surgery, but also things like meditation, optimism, resilience, and social connection. All the stuff that's always been far outside medicine's visible wavelength, but suddenly is finding a place comfortably within it. Now he's going to start talking about the studies. Okay? Consider one study, for example, showing that even a single day of mindfulness meditation practice can downregulate a gene that codes for inflammation. One day of mindfulness downregulates inflammation coding gene, one of the greatest drivers of aging. You know that inflammation seems to be, chronic inflammation seems to be implicated in all sorts of degenerations in the body. Or the one showing that reducing stress can reduce the cellular damage from the highly reactive oxygen atoms known as free radicals. So reduce stress and you reduce the damage from free radicals. Or the research that found most remarkably that the, is it telomeres or telomeres?
Telomeres is the preferred definition. Telomeres is acceptable.
Okay, so telomeres is preferred and telomeres. Thank you. That's exactly what I would have guessed. I have always said telomeres, but I hear people who are very smart saying telomeres, and so it bothers me.
I know, I looked it up.
Good for you, Chris. Thank you. As always, very good. And you probably looked it up in a dictionary, right?
Circle.
But instead of online. The kids don't, we look it up by hand, they look it up like going like this. But anyway. Okay. Or the research that found most remarkably that telomeres within your cells, the little cuffs that cap chromosomes and erode over your lifespan, can actually be made to grow longer, provided your mind is in the right state to make it happen. Carl, what is he referring to? And there's some study that meditation will actually regrow the caps. I think I read that.
Well, there's lots of things that can, to a limited extent, particularly very short ones. You can have severe damage that drastically shortens a subpopulation. Yes, and you can. Some parts of your body and some practices, diet, meditation, those things can help to make up for the ones that are really extremely short.
So they can regrow at least the very short ones.
Yeah, the extremely short ones are the ones that cause you trouble first.
Right, okay.
Like inflammation.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. It comes down to daily behavior and the choices we make, says Alyssa Appel, a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, who studies stress and aging. We have a growing set of studies of people from around the world showing that aging is not just an aspect of genetics, but of how we live, she says. Deciding to live better, it increasingly seems, is the same as deciding to live younger. So this is the study I wanted to get. I hope we get here. Yeah, we have plenty of time. Okay. So this is the study I wanted to tell you about. This is the greatest study. Okay. It wasn't until the late 1970s that researchers began seriously thinking about using the mind to arrest the aging process. And it was Ellen Langer's landmark counterclockwise study that really got things started. This is Ellen Langer of Harvard, who's really a dean of this kind of work. In 1979, when she was just beginning her Harvard teaching career, she recruited a group of 8 men in their 70s for a 5-day stay at a retreat in New Hampshire. So, 8 men in their 70s, she takes them for 5 days to a retreat in New Hampshire. The men were in neither good nor bad health, but what was considered age-appropriate health, which is to say, slow, bent, and easily fatigued. But Langer was determined to change that. The retreat, as the men discovered when they arrived, was a former monastery designed to look as the world did to them in 1959. So it's 1979, and they're going back to a place that's been refurnished to look like 1959. Vintage programs were showing on vintage televisions. Mid-century music played on mid-century radios. The men were treated, too, as if they would have been back then. No one offered to help them with their bags or fetch them a blanket. They kept their conversation to the topics they would have discussed in 1959. The doings in the Eisenhower White House, say, or the Dodgers White Sox series face-off. And lest the men get glimpses of themselves in mirrors and break the spells, all mirrors were removed. At the beginning and end of the 5-day span, Langer administered a series of physical and cognitive aptitude tests to the men. Physical and cognitive aptitude tests. And the result was as she expected. On virtually every metric, their performance improved dramatically. And in many cases, it was closer to what would have been expected for men a decade or two younger. That is, physically and cognitively, they seemed to regress to an earlier time. Okay? Dramatically, she says. Okay? The study spoke volumes to the potential we have to change our health, Langer says. At some point, people just tell us we can't. If you're 20 and you hurt your wrist, you expect it to get better. When you're 70, you've bought into the mindset that you're falling apart, and then you do. A little bit about telomeres, okay? Because you can't get away from it. Okay. Over the course of a lifetime, telomeres burn down sort of like a candle wick, leaving the chromosomes vulnerable to damage and starting the aging process. Investigators have understood the basics of telomeres since 1978, when then postdoctoral fellow Elizabeth Blackburn, now at the University of California, San Francisco, first mapped their structure, and later with her collaborator Jack Zostak of Harvard, their function. In 1984, Blackburn and her graduate student Carol Greider, now at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, discovered the enzyme telomerase, which repairs and maintains telomeres, at least when it's around in sufficient levels. When those levels fall, which happens as we get older, the aging process is kicked off. The discovery won all three of them the 2009 Nobel Prize for Medicine. When studies look at which individuals will die in the next 3 years, Blackburn says, the chances are higher if your telomeres are shorter. Telomere shortening plays into cardiovascular disease, immune system problems, and maybe diabetes by affecting beta cells in the pancreas, though that's only been shown in a mouse model so far. End quote. The question is, are there ways to intervene to spare the telomeres and preserve your health? The answer, at least preliminarily, is yes, and stress reduction is one powerful method. In 2014, Appel, and that's a woman we talked about earlier, at UCSF, and her colleague, Eli Perdaman, also of the University of California, San Francisco, studied 239 healthy postmenopausal women over the course of a year. Many of the subjects were experiencing at least one of 13 major life stressors, which included unemployment in the family, financial woes, divorce, and the illness of a child. So these are 239 healthy postmenopausal women studied for a year, many of whom were experiencing a major stressor. The length of their telomeres was measured at the beginning and end of the year, and the more life stressors these women experienced in that year, the more their telomeres shortened. But some of the women also practiced good health behaviors. They exercised, ate well, and slept well. Consistently, the women who practiced good health behaviors maintained their telomere length. Quote, the question has always been whether the telomeres respond to daily lifestyle changes or if the system is chronic and proceeds at its own pace. In our study, it was lifestyle, with damage occurring mostly in people who are sedentary. That is, stress will shorten your telomeres unless you practice good health habits, in which case your telomeres are protected. Worse, telomere shortening stress is not confined to older people and does not even have to be experienced firsthand. Appel cites studies showing that when cord blood is drawn from newborns, the babies whose mothers had experienced more stress when they were pregnant had shorter telomeres than those whose moms had easier pregnancies. So already in the kid whose mother is stressed, the telomeres are shorter when the child is born than children whose mothers didn't experience stress. We replicated that original finding, Eppel said, and it suggests healthy telomere maintenance doesn't start when you're born, but before you're born. You know how when you're under stress, you say to yourself, oh my God, I'm aging so fast? And if you reverse that, if you get rid of that stress or you take better care of yourself, you seem to rejuvenate? I don't know about the rejuvenation part, but it's clear that the aging part really is happening. Okay, that a lot of chronic stress ages people quicker, and it's one way that it does that is through this mechanism. Okay. Telomeres aren't the only big stress-related players in the aging game. Another is chronic inflammation. When you're anxious, the sympathetic nervous system, which is not known for thinking things through too clearly, assumes you're about to encounter a predator or some other life-threatening challenge. The sympathetic nervous system puts you in fight or flight. The brain thus sends a signal to the adrenal gland to start secreting the hormones epinephrine, that is adrenaline, and cortisol. Together, these hormones signal the immune system to release proteins known as inflammatory cytokines. These prepare white blood cells and other infection fighters to rush to the site of an anticipated wound. Okay, so, to review, when you are under stress, the sympathetic nervous system sends your body into fight or flight. In fight or flight, your adrenal glands secrete into your bloodstream adrenaline, also known as epinephrine, and cortisol. And that tells your immune system to release into the bloodstream cytokines, which are inflammatory proteins. That causes your system to inflame. The inflammation causes you to have more capacity to fight off infection. If you got fanged, you'd inflame in that area. The white blood cells would go there to combat the infection. So in the short term, you want inflammation. Inflammation, if you cut yourself, you get inflamed around the cut, right? It gets red. That's so that you don't get infected through that cut. So in the short term, inflammation is a good thing. That works quite well when there's really a wound, or when the danger is fleeting and you escape without injury. Either way, the system, thanks largely to cortisol, dials itself back down, away from inflammation. But what if you're always braced for a battle of some kind, with your boss, your kids, your credit card statements, and the body is always flooded with inflammatory chemicals? In those cases, the body suffers from what's known as inflammation, and that's bad. There is no invader as there is with a wound, but we're reacting as if there is anyway, says Eppo. That creates a friendly environment for cancer, brain deterioration, and cardiovascular disease. In other words, for many of the killers of aging. Chronic inflammation seems to be implicated in one way or another in cancer, heart disease, and brain losing of functioning. One of the best ways to battle this is with a settled psychic state through meditation and mindfulness exercises. Increasingly, researchers are finding that particular form of meditation known as mindfulness-based stress reduction, also known as mindfulness, which as its name suggests includes paying close attention to feelings, thoughts, and other stimuli while meditating, can calm an inflamed immune system in the same way as it can calm an inflamed mood. That is, when you're meditating, you're not only calming yourself down emotionally, you're also calming yourself down physically. In 2013, Richard Davidson, a neuroscientist and the founder of the Center for Investigating Healthy Minds at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, conducted a pair of studies showing just how powerful an effect MBSR can have on the body. In one, he and his colleagues compared 40 subjects, 21 of whom engaged in 8 hours of a combination of guided meditation, meditative walks, and lectures on meditation, and 19 of whom engaged in equally relaxing activities, but without the meditation. So, 40 subjects, 21 of whom get 8 hours of mindfulness practice, 19 of whom get relaxation for 8 hours, but without the mindfulness practice. At the end of even so brief a period as 8 hours, the meditators showed a decrease in the expression of the very genes that regulate inflammation, meaning a decrease in inflammation itself. That is, the 8 hours down-regulated the inflammation-causing genes in the meditators, but not in the people who relaxed. Another study replicated the findings over the course of 8 weeks, and at the end, the experimenters used a suction device to raise a small blister on the arms of subjects. When fluid was withdrawn, the meditators showed significantly lower levels of inflammatory cytokines, the same cytokines that do so much damage when they circulate in the body chronically. So the meditators did better than the control group in having less inflammation after the 8-week course of mindfulness. The regular practice of certain contemplative methods seems to be able to alter the trajectory of age-related changes, Davidson says. Some studies even show that meditation can slow the age-related decline of gray matter in the brain. And that's very preliminary stuff, but it seems as though certain areas in the brain, at least, slow their decline less... The decline is slower in meditators than in non-meditators. And maybe even is arrested entirely. There are certain areas, preliminarily it seems like they don't decline. On this last point, Davidson understates things. Here's the research. Okay. Exciting research published in February out of UCLA compared two sample groups of 50 people ranging in age from 24 to 77. So two sample groups of people ranging in age from 24 to 77. A good demographic slice, since gray matter actually begins declining when we're in our 20s. One group was made of, two groups of 50. One of the groups of 50 is made of people who did not meditate. The other group are made of people who have been regular meditators for anywhere from 4 to 46 years. So practice meditators for a long term versus non-meditators. All 100 subjects' brains were scanned with magnetic resonance imaging, and the results were unmistakable. The meditators showed less gray matter loss in several regions of the brain compared with the non-meditators. Quote, "We expected rather small and distinct effects located in some of the regions that had been previously associated with meditating," said Dr. Florian Kurth, co-author of the study. "Instead, what we actually observed was a widespread effect of meditation that encompassed regions throughout the entire brain." Good, I'll get to finish this article. Bob.
At this point, I'd like to ask if you or anyone in the audience knows people that have used mindfulness to defeat or combat influenza, because I did a little research, just very briefly, I'll just touch on the internet, that they're now, with the genetic recreation of the famous influenza epidemic of 1918, have figured out that most of the people died, or the reason that was so fatal was it was overexciting cytokines, and it became an autoimmune disease. Excited the immune system of these people that they started attacking their own body.
Yeah.
And so I was just kind of wondering if you were really good at mindfulness meditation, maybe you could kind of restore this balance of the body and your immune system. And a practical application today would be people have had influenza. I don't have very many colds or influenza. I don't think I've ever had it, but if people have had it and then used meditation to get rid of the symptoms,
That's very interesting. So I haven't heard anything about influenza, but there's a famous mindfulness study. They gave two groups of people colds, and then they saw how severe they were and how long they lasted. And the people who meditated had much less severe and long-lasting colds. Carrie, and then I want to read you. Loud. Say again?
Would it hold that 10 minutes a day of meditation would be good, or would be better?
I think, I'm guessing that there's a curve like this. That is, or a curve like this. That is, if you don't do it at all, a little bit of it gives you a big boost. If you do it some more, it gives you somewhat of a boost. And if you do it some more, it gives you just a little bit more of a boost. So I think maybe 10 minutes is way better than no minutes. 20 minutes is somewhat better than 10 minutes. 30 minutes is a little bit better than 20 minutes. 5 hours is very little better than, you know. Understand? So that's my guess, because that's the way these things tend to run, but I haven't done the research. So I wouldn't obsess about this. However, if I were under a lot of stress, or if I were fighting off an illness, I would meditate seriously. Okay, I would say, look, I'm gonna meditate several times today for 15 minutes each time, at least, to really see if I can stop this from developing, or to really down-regulate the stress.
But it's mindfulness, not concentration meditation.
It's mindfulness, yeah. Okay. At least the research is on that. Okay, last things about this. I'm going to actually probably next week read you a little bit of a couple more of the articles, because they're all interesting. Okay, the optimism effect. Almost as powerful as meditation, and certainly easier for people who would be perfectly happy to set aside time for solitary contemplation in a quiet place if they could find the hour in the quiet place to do it, is simply optimism. Challenges and setbacks and even tragedies are non-negotiable parts of life, but what is negotiable is how you face them. Dr. Hilary Tindall, a physician and clinical investigator at Vanderbilt University, has produced a body of work on the connection between attitude and health, and all of it points to the improbable power of just being hopeful. In one massive 2009 study, Tindall analyzed data from 97,253 women who had filled out questionnaires for the National Institute of Health's Women's Health Initiative, trying to correlate hopefulness and mortality. Women who scored high on optimism, being hopeful about the future, the results showed had significantly lower rates of heart disease, cancer, and mortality than women who scored high on pessimism. And this is a huge sample, so individual differences are washed out. So women who were more hopeful had less heart disease, cancer, and died less frequently. Died less. less of them died. All right, the very last thing. You guys are so smart. I couldn't get that one by you. Okay. All right, last statement here. Researchers are divided on how possible it is for people who have made it to middle age, cynical or stressed or sedentary, to undo all the damage to their systems through outlook change and meditation alone. But the research is piling up that it can help and it certainly can't hurt. As with most matters involving health, it comes down in large measure to lifestyle, diet, exercise, adequate sleep, and positive attitude. That's not sexy, but when it comes to longevity, take what works over what makes headlines. All of which is to say, the summary comment here is that degenerating when you age is not a default. Or it is a default if you don't take care of yourself mentally and physically. But more and more research is showing that what we grew up expecting to happen to us is not necessarily what can and will happen to us. Okay? And that these practices, these physical practices and these mental practices, have really significant effects. Not tiny effects, but determinative effects. One comment? Does anybody have any comment or question? Carl, okay, you should get the summary comment, Carl.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And thank Carl, because Carl is really going into this in detail. So every once in a while, we'll tap his expertise, and as his course on goes, more of you will find your way there. Okay, have a great week. See you in a week. Thank you.